Hey, podcast listeners, you're listening to a recording made in Los Gatos on the 1st of June, 2015. And we know that's different from the date you're about to hear, but don't worry about it. That's just for the broadcast listeners. Thank you for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, June 6th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Geek Translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Brian Young, iOS developer, designer, and computer graphics artist. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Bonnie. Good to be here.
Good. It's good to have you here. Also, Lyle Troxell, maker, photographer, father, and senior user interface engineer at Netflix.
Howdy, Bonnie.
Howdy. And Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek.
Hola.
Hola.
No, hola is what I want to talk about.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about the Hola VPN.
The Hola VPN.
Talk about a segue.
Yeah. What's a VPN again?
A VPN is a virtual private network, and you...
I was going to say that, Ben.
Lyle wants to talk about it.
Lyle, you work at Netflix, so yeah, you have some experience with this.
So when you actually connect to your ISP, your internet service provider, they give you a public IP address or some access to a public IP address. And then when you interact with the internet, you're actually interacting from their point of view, from where they are.
Okay.
So when you connect to Comcast or whatever from home, your IP address is actually related to Comcast, and they can relate you then to you because you have an account with them. So you don't have anonymousness. You are very much a member of their network. And virtual private networks allow you to pay somebody else or get access to another network. And therefore, though it's not the network you're signed in with, it looks like that's where you're coming from. And it's a very interesting feature that you can now get a VPN server, for example, in Spain, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden appear like you are entering the internet from Spain, even though you have a private tunnel from your own home.
And does that mean you can watch Spanish stuff that's otherwise not available? Because I know people who are fans of, for instance, British TV are thwarted from being able to see it, or people over the pond want to be able to watch our American television shows on the internets.
Yeah, and the reason I mentioned Netflix is because a lot of people will want to watch shows that are not allowed, they're not licensed to be available in the mm-hmm. region where the person is accessing them from. So they'll pay for or find a free VPN. And they'll log in through there, and all their traffic will go through that point mm-hmm. that's in some other network. Hmm. And they'll be able to get the content that is regionally, I guess, defined.
And so Hola is from Spain? It's a way of doing that in Spain?
Not from Spain, but it is a VPN, mm-hmm. and it's a free VPN, which is kind
like
of
those.
Everybody likes free stuff.
Wait, except how do they get their monies?
Yeah, right, exactly. So a friend of mine likes saying that if you aren't paying for it, then you are the product.
Yeah.
Right?
Whoops.
So
was that me or was that a different friend?
A different
friend. Oh, I said that too.
Yeah. So so why should you not use Hola? Well, it turns out Hola in particular, there are tons and tons of reasons that you shouldn't use Hola.
Oops.
Because, here are a couple of things that Hola is doing. First of all, it is it's using your connection as an out point, not just a point that you connect to other computers from, but that other people can route their traffic through your computer.
Oh, so it's like a group obfuscation device.
Right. But they do that without your knowledge, if you don't research it, and without your approval, and without any way to opt out. And they also sell your network access, which is not good.
And they profit, but you don't.
Mm-hmm. So there's that. They also don't enforce any rules in terms of what people are using it for. Mm-hmm. So somebody could be doing totally illegal things and basically going through your internet connection.
Okay, that's why a person might object to that sort of thing.
That's really, really bad. Mm-hmm. Additionally, if you install Hola and you're using it, they have several security vulnerabilities which can let other people take over your computer and use it and get privileged access to your computer and run code from your computer. Hmm. So that's really, really bad. That's just a huge vulnerability as well as a botnet.
So wait, Ben, I've got a Mac and I can set myself up for a VPN. And I'm just using the operating system and I'm putting in the appropriate settings. But it sounds like Ola is doing something more. You're installing their software?
Yeah, you install their software and then you basically they open you up to a whole bunch of potential security vulnerabilities.
Okay.
So really bad. Also, they have been handling it extremely poorly. If no one assumed malice and greed before, I don't know. It's pretty damning watching the way that they are responding to all of this. Mm-hmm. So rather than actually address some of the issues that have been brought up, they've just quietly changed their frequently asked questions on their website.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So, so hola, adios. Really, no one should be...
Funny you say that, actually, and this was not planned for any of our listeners. There is a website called adioshola.org with a dash, and it's been set up, I believe, by some of the security researchers who were talking about Ola, and it just goes over all of the horrible things that can happen to you if you use Ola and all of the... Like, for example, they have a little button on their website, and... It says, oh, I'm finding it now. That's right. There's a button that says exploit me. And if you click on it, it'll open the calculator application on your computer, proving that it can indeed execute code on your computer. Mm-hmm. It's pretty bad. So if you happen to be using Ola or let's say the Ola VPN to watch Netflix or do other things, go ahead and uninstall that right away.
Get a different one.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, are we kind of a VPN-friendly organization? We think VPNs are okay?
I mean, I have no problem with VPNs. It's a tool in your tool belt, right? Mm-hmm. You can use it to do illegal things. You can use it also to bypass contents, licensing kinds of stuff that other companies might want to impose on you. And that's, of course, your choice if you decide to use it that way. But I guess the biggest takeaway for me is to just stress, urge everybody, if you have a free service, think about what are they getting out of it in return? Are they getting your data? Are they getting to advertise to you? Are they getting to run whatever they want on your computer and sell your bandwidth? Like, what's going on there? And so if you're using a service like a VPN and you want to do that, then you may want to go ahead and pay for that.
And when VPNs are used to watch programming that's otherwise not available, that must be consternating to companies that are trying to limit availability of shows.
Yeah, I'd say generally so. And I guess it's up to the companies how aggressive they want to be in trying to detect that and deal with it.
Sounds like another cat and mouse department will be forming at companies. All right. So that's it. If you're considering a VPN... GeekSpeak officially does not recommend Ola. No.
The opposite.
Yeah. All right. And we also want to talk about new developments at Google. There used to be a thing called Google Plus Photos, which is no more. Now it's something else entirely.
Yeah, now it's just called Google Photos. And I've been using it. I started using Google Plus early on because of, I don't know, because I'm a nerd. And What I found with one of the things I loved about Google Plus is uploading all your photos, because one of the things that Google Plus was doing was taking the photos and converting them and making like automatic stories and automatic movies of your days. And on an Android device for quite a while, you've been able to edit those movies that it creates, change the theme songs, things of that nature, and also modify your stories pretty easily. And iOS hasn't had that feature. So this last week at Google I/O, Google announced Google Photos for iOS.
So let's go over some acronyms here. At Google I/O,
I/O is a standard term in computer technology to reference in and out.
Right. Input output.
Input output. Got it.
You access your hard drive through I/O through input output.
And Google I/O is what?
It's just their developer conference, kind of like the worldwide developers conference of Apple's, which is happening in a couple weeks.
Okay. Generally speaking, the place that they announce a lot of new stuff.
Okay.
So the couple weeks up until Google I/O, everyone at Google was stressing out and trying to finish all of their software projects.
That's right. Google Plus, Google Plus has had this feature, some of these features built in. Now they've kind of spun it out as their own app, the Google Photos. And the other thing that Google Photos allows you to do is search photos in a very interesting way. You can back up all your photos, and they're doing unlimited storage as long as they choose the resolution. So all the photos you have on your phone will go up to this cloud space. They'll look at those. Yeah.
You said they get to choose the resolution?
Well, they say that it's unlimited storage if they choose the good quality resolution. If you want to have the raw photos, then you have to pay for the storage.
Oh, okay.
So they're just going to pick a point of pixel density that's valid for them, right?
So it's a great way to have your photos in the cloud for free, but it's not a backup. It's not an archive.
That's right. Though I would argue that their high resolution is probably fine. So one of the things they're going to do is they're going to analyze your photos, and they're going to do things like, for a while they've been doing this. If you take 14 pictures of one person in kind of one area, mm-hmm. it will make an animated GIF of that. It will stitch them together and make like a short movie.
That's fun.
It's fun, right?
Yeah.
It also will... If you do kind of a shot from a stable location and something passes through the scene, they will give you a copy of the picture without that thing that moved through the scene, and they'll give you another copy of that picture of the thing that's moving through the scene with lots of little steps. So they kind of create extra artifacts out of your timeline of photos.
Wow.
But Google Photos now is allowing you to completely search your collection in a neat way. And the best way to describe this is for me to show this to you, Bonnie, though we're not really close to each other, so it's a little difficult. But basically, they're going to analyze the photo, and they're mm-hmm. going to say, that's a human, that's a human, that's a human. Collect all those people together and group them into people's faces. So now all of a sudden, my collection has all these different pictures that I've taken with people in there. So I see a picture of Ben here on my photo collection, uh-huh. and I click on his face, and sure enough, hundreds of pictures of Ben show up
Ben's
automatically.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the pictures I've taken of you that it uploaded
and
to
did you
Google.
Go you didn't go through and tag any of these.
I didn't tag any of these. In fact, they don't even know it's called Ben. They just know it's a person that looks the same.
So this is facial detection going on.
That's right. Then they're going to do things like geolocation, which I do give the information. My phone actually registers that.
Yeah.
So when you take a photo, geolocation, the place on the earth that you are when you take the photo, that data gets put into the
So
the
my places
image.
Thing
I've
says...
I've noticed that when I take a photo, it says that I'm in some weird sub-neighborhood of Los Gatos.
Right. You didn't even know what the name was, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm seeing this, you know, San Jose, Santa Cruz, Felton, Paris, you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. So all my photos from those areas. That's nice, but that's not a feature that's like a cognitive intelligence kind of thing. But the next thing is really interesting, because you can actually see all the dog pictures I've taken, even mm-hmm. though I haven't labeled them dog, because Google knows what a dog, or the algorithms know what a dog looks like, mm-hmm. and so they've tagged all the pictures of mine that have dogs. And cars, and sky, and forests, and beaches, and flowers. And I can search my collection to get all the pictures with dogs and flowers in it really easily. So I'll go and see if I have any dog flowers.
Oh, wow. So you've got, I've got a side question about if they group then the dog photos by dog, are they good at figuring out dog portraiture? Or do all dogs look the same to Google?
They haven't broken out the dogs by species or anything
species
like that.
Those species jerks.
But here it is. Yeah, hundreds. I mean, a few pictures of dogs and flowers.
So you just searched for dog flowers, literally.
Yes.
And it just came back with a bunch of images.
Yeah.
None of which you tagged with dog or flower. It's just has...
It's sort of auto-tagging.
Right. It's put all of these images through their machine learning algorithms to figure out what objects, what people are in these different photos. And we've actually covered some breakthroughs in machine learning on the show before several
times.
Right,
yeah. It's a favorite subject.
And on your program as well, the other program that you do, mm-hmm. Which is called...
Linear Digressions.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's about machine learning.
So I just searched for cats. Now, there are pictures of cats, but I have a lot more dogs than cats. And sure enough, some of the pictures of dogs look like the pictures of cats to the computer algorithm, because that is a very difficult thing for an algorithm to do.
Determine if it's a cat or dog. Because it is a jerk. All right, just reiterate that. All right, so, I mean, it's kind of fun thinking that, oh, thank goodness, Google do the tagging for me, except when you get to the, oh, now we know what Ben looks like.
So
like when it gets to be sort of personal identification, that's where my creep dart goes off.
Well, how about this one? How about, wow, the person that is Lyle goes to the beach, you know, a lot, has flowers in his yard. He might want mulch, and so I'll advertise mulch to him because he has flowers in his yard, right?
So smart advertising possibilities.
Yeah. And then trademark detection and any text detection is automatic as well. So if I were the type of person that had Budweiser beer around me all the time, they would know that I drank Budweiser, right, because of the photographs.
Able to advertise more Bud for you.
Yeah. So
it's not all that far of a jump to say, oh, Lyle, you're hanging out with Greg, and we know Greg likes Budweiser. Why don't you get some Budweiser?
Ooh.
Okay, so this sounds pretty dark and pretty sinister, but
I just tried squirming.
I'm sure there's some good uses to that. Like, who knows? Maybe they'd make an API where somebody could make a health app and say, "You eat too much McDonald's," or something like that.
Oh, the nanny state proceeds.
I mean, so technologically, what they're doing is really, really phenomenal.
It's amazing.
It is absolutely incredible. It's something that we've been kind of diving for, striving for mm-hmm. over the last couple decades, trying to get machine learning to the point where I can actually recognize objects to some degree.
I mean, this is a practical application of some of the research that you've been covering over, over the years here.
I got to say, now that I've uploaded like tons of photos from 2 years, being able to search for wire is really cool. Like anything you want to search for, you can search your own photos for. It's amazing. So
it doesn't always work, though. You just search for circle, and I don't see any circles. Answers.
But it's the same way that a Google search doesn't always get you exactly the thing you're looking for.
Wait.
Circle worked really well, actually. Beautiful pictures of circles.
How many things is it identifying? Could I find a lost object by looking through my photos? Can I just Google that lost bag that I haven't seen in 3 months?
What's it called?
You'd find a photo of it.
It's the
probably
would be able to identify it on the planet. That'd
probably if Google put resources into running your specific bag as a training set through its machine learning algorithm. I'm not sure what they're actually doing in the background and how much optimization for particular objects they're doing, like common objects, versus just kind of running it through and hoping that it'll get what's important to humans.
Lyle, how many categories did you end up with, or how many objects?
So there are general categories, but those are about the amount of density you have of that type. So the categories for me are like dogs, forest, cars, sky, food, flowers, beaches. There's only like that many. But those are just ones that I have a lot of pictures of, and so they grouped them into. But then if I type for something like bag, I found bags. So it's not doesn't seem like a limited set. It's a little amazing. But at the same time...
How are you feeling right now, Lyle?
Well, the thing is... Okay, so I have like 200,000 photographs in my library of photographs.
You've
taken
a lot of photographs.
Yeah. And for a long time, I spent quite a bit of time tagging all those photographs with people's names. And now it feels like Google could help me not do that anymore. And I like that idea. And I just have to trade my privacy soul for that.
Do you feel bummed that you spent that many hours of your life tagging all these pictures with all this metadata and now it can just happen?
I'm not someone that gets upset about doing things. So, no, I'm happy I did that, and it was interesting. Yeah, it's part of who I am.
Good grief.
So how much of our soul are we turning over to Google in order to have these conveniences? These
very philosophical question there.
I mean, we can get into that all day. I've just been reflecting that more and more, you know, Google is deciding what resolution works. Google is deciding, companies are deciding which domains you can view things from. Decisions are being made for us all the time already, and I think we can predict more of that. We'll talk more about that when we come back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. A reminder for fans of this program to consider also checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9 or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. What happens is every week Robert talks with a bright mind in the arts or the sciences, and then we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly, and you can hear it tomorrow at noon on KUSP, or check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. That's 7thAvenueProject.com. So we were talking about Google and advancements at Google, and was this the only thing they talked about at Google I.O.?
Well, yeah, they actually talked about quite a few things. I was there, and it was fun. One quick update on the Google Photo resolution and all that stuff. They are giving away unlimited 16 megapixel and lower quality. If you want to store your photos in RAW or any higher resolutions, then that counts towards your normal quota that they would normally give you. So it's not that they're saying that all of your photos have to be 16 megapixels or lower. It's that they've made a cost-benefit analysis and decided, you know what, we're willing to store this quality for free for you, unlimited.
They're making a judgment that not everybody has 200,000 photos like Lyle.
Yeah.
Just test me.
He'll make up for everybody else's.
That not everyone needs their 200,000 photos stored all in RAW.
Yeah.
I do.
Well, so what else did they talk about at Google I.O., though?
Yeah, what was it like?
Well, it was a Silicon Valley tech conference. It's kind of strange. I mean, Silicon Valley in general is really strange, you know? So, like,
Is it like the show?
I actually don't watch TV, so I'm a bad Netflix customer. I'm sorry.
You're an awesome radio person, though, Ben.
Thank you. So, they took up Moscone West, which is a very large venue for those of you who have not been to San Francisco.
A classic convention venue.
Yeah, it's got three floors, and they basically carpeted the entire thing. And yeah, with these custom colors, and they put up all these little walls and everything. They had a couple of either near or fully 360 degree projection rooms. Oh. So one of them, they did all of their ATAP announcements. ATAP is a particular branch of Google that moves really fast.
Google Advanced Technology and Projects.
Oh, wow. I didn't know the acronym. Yeah. So they just iterate really, really fast and launch really crazy, kind of moonshotty ideas.
Hmm. Did you get a chance to look at Soil?
Soil?
That's a little gesture thing.
Oh, that's Soul, I think. Oh, Project Soul or Soul?
Soul? It could be
Soul.
Soli.
It's Soli, not Soil.
Oh. Soil.
S-O-L-E. Or S-O-L-L-I. Yeah, that was really neat. So the idea there is they've within the last 10 or 11 months, it was within the year, right? Mm-hmm. They developed a prototype and then shrunk it down small enough to be inside of basically slightly larger than normal watch. And what it is this little radar chip, which kind of looks all around it and kind of watches your hands and can detect where your fingers are and can respond based on where your fingers are. So, for example, if you've ever been staring at your smartwatch, which I don't because I don't have a smartwatch that has a touchscreen, but for those of us who do, if you're staring at your smartwatch and you're trying to like deal with the teeny little screen and everything with mm-hmm. your fat fingers, mm-hmm. there's clearly a user interface or your user experience issue there.
Yeah.
You've got fat fingers, they're not transparent fingers, and you've got a very small screen. So how do you interact with your watch, right? Also, what if your hands are full with groceries and you want to, you know, check
yeah,
and see
you
what your next meeting is?
Or what? Yeah.
So there's all those issues. And they showed off what I think was a very technically impressive demo where they could move their fingers independently and the little radar chip understood where their fingers were in space and they could use that to interact with the device.
So you could just point in space and your watch would go, got it, I'll get you that thing.
Well, kind of, to some extent. You could also slide your fingers along each other. Or tap your fingers to each other, and depending on which you tapped, it would understand and be able to do different things that you could program. You could also do things like if you take your pointer finger and your thumb and you just kind of move them against each other, almost like you're twisting a very, very thin knob. Mm-hmm. You could do something.
Or a teeny, tiny booger.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Yeah, no problem.
You could do that also to interact with what's on your watch. Now, this is a prototype, so that should be just stated very clearly, but the technology and the idea, the potential for interacting with very small devices was really quite amazing.
And this technology is very similar to Leap's technology, Leap Motion, which does the same type of thing. I think, Brian, you first showed me Leap Motion on some link, but basically it's a little device that sits
Leap?
In front of your computer.
Like L-E-A-P?
Yeah.
Okay.
L-E-A-P Motion. And it basically is the same type of thing. It doesn't use radar, though. It uses something else. I think it was using optics. Mm-hmm. But the big thing about this is that having one sensor of radar and bouncing back, they're able to kind of recreate the scene that's being seen in a really complex way, which means that you're not having as much necessity for multiple location tracking. So, for example, the other device that we commonly see this kind of thing in is LiDAR, which is how the cars drive. Mm. And then the other thing that you'll see is multiple IR cameras with laser scanning, and that's what's in the Xbox Kinect sensor. So these things all require quite a bit of energy, though, because you have to bombard everything with light that's bright enough to then be picked up, even in sunlight.
LiDAR,
in this situation, it's radar. It's a different frequency, and therefore,
lower.
It's not something that's going to be a low light and high light sensitivity uh-huh. issue.
Well, it sounds like they have to actually send a light that can go through the
through
bone
your
skin.
Hand.
Yeah. Don't they have to use a really high frequency?
No, you don't have to go through the bones of your hand or anything.
Not the bone, but you have to in some way see through your hands and fingers?
No, you don't have to see through your hands and fingers. What you're seeing is the bottom reflection of the radar against your tissue. What's tricky about it is that since it's going all the time, as you move your hands, the signature that can be then interpreted again to be turned back into that represents a hand at this motion. So it's a lot of artificial intelligence in there to make the waveform that you're seeing turn back into some kind of representation of a hand. But the cool thing about this is that we will see another breakthrough, another wave of interface design, all based off 3D spatial stuff with your hands, and it's cheap and low power, which is the exciting part of it.
For those with a steady hand.
Yeah, right. And actually, the demo, one of the women up on stage held out her hand while she was giving this demo. She was one of the leads on this project and was demonstrating these very fine gesture motions while announcing basically this product that she's been working on mm-hmm. on stage in front of a bunch of people. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, first of all, how have the last couple of week's been for you? And she said, very stressful. You know, cramming to get all of this stuff in. And second of all, I said, nicely done on the having a not shaky hand while you're, one, announcing,
so
the,
nervous.
Announcing your baby to the world, and two, demoing it in front of millions of live stream people. I mean, so that was, that
I,
was
I love
good,
that it was her hand itself. Like, she couldn't shake it all. Right. It should be totally calm. That's great.
So that was pretty cool.
I mean, it makes me think of a theremin, of course, you know, where your sort of gestures in the air control
like
the sound.
Yeah. There was also another technology that they talked about, which was what some people are calling wearable cloth, which to people who have not been following wearables.
So all cloth could really potentially be wearable?
Funny.
But it's smart cloth, right?
It's, I mean, it's I think Lyle's lost
Lyle
it.
Lyle lost it, yeah.
Ooh, cloth you can wear? How novel.
Right. So for those of you who have not been following the
Emperor who
watch
had no clothes
scene.
It's very
the nudist colony perspective on cloth. Well, you can wear that stuff?
Yeah. So your smart watch and everything are typically these days called wearables, and now we're talking about cloth.
We're gonna have real life smarty pants.
So we're So now we're talking about cloth that you can actually, you can touch and interact with, and it's got these little metal threads woven in, so it can tell where you're touching on the cloth. Mm. So that'll, basically, the idea is that it can expand the interaction surface from what's on your teeny little watch screen onto maybe your arm or your jacket or whatever. So,
okay. So they're
again, very much
approaching
a prototype.
It from different angles. Are we going to head straight for a VHS versus Betamax conundrum here?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure other companies will get in on this and will announce their own research and everything.
Approach.
So the one other thing that I was excited about is they have a potential, and unfortunately headlines are overplaying it, to kill passwords.
Yeah.
And this was actually the project Acrobat?
Abacus.
It? Abacus.
Abacus.
Okay,
Abacus.
No, I messed up with soil and soli, so I wasn't sure.
Abracadabra.
And Abacus is basically the idea is let's have an algorithm that looks for the way a person uses a computer and over time gets to know how they use it, how they type, how they might do backspaces, how they move their mouse, how they might write phrases.
Well,
anything,
and that research has been done already. We've reported on that before on GeekSpeak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this project is in designed to potentially be a way of authenticating a human being without a password. So you just start using your computer, and after a while, they're like, yeah, we're 90% sure it's Bonnie.
What do you do in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime, you know, use the computer.
You use passwords, yeah.
Yeah.
So you get locked out later?
They say that it could actually be better than a human fingerprint for a security perspective, because a fingerprint, of course, can be duplicated and, you know, scanned and things of that nature.
As long as your brain's healthy, right? I mean, if you change enough in your mind, then
like
you're going to start moving different.
Right,
like,
Saturday morning after drinking all night, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I really wanted to see the photos from last night.
Now,
Everyone's seen them by now.
Just to tie what you just said together, there's one other very interesting thing that they announced at the Google Photos talk, which also connects to what you were saying about authentication. Like, as your mind goes downhill, maybe you start typing a little bit differently. They were actually able to not only identify people as they are now with their faces, but also go back in time to where people were, like kids and babies and infants, right? And presumably the way they do that is by looking at, say, a six-year-old's face and correlating strongly with that same person at 5 years old and 4 years old, and then they keep running each of those sets of photos through the machine learning algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. So if you had an infant and a bunch of pictures of this infant and then no photos for like 3 years, it wouldn't be able to do that. But if you have enough photos, it can go backwards and actually identify people all the way to closely, like soon after they were born. And similarly, if you're doing all the time authentication, like we were talking about with Google's Project Abacus and a number of other research efforts, presumably you could also watch as a person evolves over time or devolves over time in terms of the way that they type and the way that they interact with the computer.
I'm sure everything will be fine. I mean, aren't you just getting a little bit concerned that there? I mean, we are approaching the singularity, right? I mean, the amount of learning will quickly surpass what we're able to manage, and by manage, I mean maintaining one's own sense of individuality and privacy among all of this sort of gleaning of our information just by how we breathe. Am I putting on the tin hat?
Oh, I think the machine learning is still pretty young.
Yeah.
But the amount of data here and the usefulness of it is incredible. It's just a matter of whether it's going to be used well or whether we're going to run into these scary stories of Google using it to advertise to us or worse.
Let's not keep it just to Google. We haven't talked about Facebook all show.
No, we haven't. they're usually the first at the top of the security and privacy issues, right?
Yeah. But one thing before we move on, I just want to say that back maybe 10 or however many years ago, we were talking about these same issues with like, our email contents or the way we interact with our web searches are going to be used to advertise for us, right? And there is an argument to be made to say that, you know, maybe that's not actually so bad. If it causes us to buy more than we want, that I think is the bad element of it. But smart advertisement, I think, can actually be useful in some cases, right?
Well, and apparently very few of us are actually clicking on the Google ads.
I don't know. I mean, enough people are clicking on the Google ads for Google to have so much money that they're willing to fund crazy moonshot projects and, you know, things like self-driving cars, which are going to be very long-term return on investments, you know, like, and yet they're putting a lot of money into it. So I don't know. I mean, like, there is kind of the creepy element to it and the, where is our world going to go element to it. But I don't know. I think
you
can
see yourself living comfortably in that world.
I'm more concerned with my data not being sufficiently protected from more nefarious people, right? Mm. I wouldn't think of, say, a corporation like Google choosing to advertise intelligently to me as being nefarious. Maybe,
but
it
they
could
might
be,
create conditions for some unintended blowback among the nefarious crowd.
Well, mainly I'm thinking that if their security isn't good enough and someone gets in, and it's probably only a matter of time for any particular company, right? Especially for a target like Google or Apple or Facebook.
Right.
If some nefarious person gets a bunch of data about me, there's a lot that they can do, right?
And well, there's and you a said lot of target. So, I mean, it sort of reminds me of all of the security breaches that we have been having.
Absolutely. You know? And so Google is very security minded, but as opposed to say a company like Sony, right? Mm-hmm. But they also are sitting on a gold mine for nefarious people. So that's what I'm mostly worried about.
All right. Well, if we stick around long enough, we'll be able to see what happens. We'll talk more about what is happening when we come back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Brian Young, Ben Jaffe, and Lyle Troxell. And if you'd like to communicate with the show, one way you can reach Geek Speak is via Twitter. We're at KUSP Geeks. That's all one word. If you have questions or comments for us, you can send us a tweet and we'll collect them up and respond in the future. All right. So I mentioned Facebook a moment ago. They have done something interesting lately.
Yeah, they're helping something out.
What can you tell us about that, Brian?
What would you say is the least secure way to send a private message on the internet?
Over Facebook?
I have an answer. I have an answer.
Yeah,
what's your answer?
Don't use the internet.
Yeah,
how about an encrypted email? Like an email? I mean, if you want the data itself to be private,
encrypted, the least private or the most private?
Oh, I was going for the least private. Well, no, I'm sorry, the
most private.
The most broken way to send a private message.
The worst way to try and.
A non-encrypted email.
Yeah. So email has a horrible history of being terribly not private.
It's super trackable.
Yeah. Every email message you send goes out in plain text in some way and bounces around all these servers on the internet until it finds the server you're trying to send it to. And anybody along the way can take a look at a snippet of that email or the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Now we know that somebody is watching always, pretty much, the NSA, if no one else.
Yeah, there's
well,
at least one
organization. It's getting hoovered up for further viewing later, at the very least.
So for a long time, people have tried to figure out a way to make email better. And there's a good argument to say email is just fundamentally broken. But there has been for a long time something called pretty good privacy.
Mm-hmm.
A way to
PGP.
PGP, or the open source version of that, which is GPG.
GNU Privacy Guard, yeah.
Yeah. So this has been available for a long time, but nobody uses it. It's a complex system, and one of the basic problems with it is you have to be able to get a key your public key to somebody that wants to send a message to you. Mm-hmm. So if you, Bonnie, wanted to send me your tax records and I'm your accountant, sending it by email would be a terrible idea.
Okay.
Unless you encrypted it. So I, your tax accountant, might share my key with you, mm-hmm. and you'd say, okay, great. Using PGP, GPG, you would encrypt that message, lock it up, and use my public key to do it. And then you
now,
mail it to me.
I'm not aware of doing all those steps when I send anything.
You have to be aware of one thing, which is that you have to in some way sign that message, encrypt it with this key that you had shared with you. And that's the complex part. How do you get that key to a person? How does that person use that key? Mm-hmm. And there's a number of services around the internet that allow you to do this. It's called
Key Exchange. We've talked about this subject before on GeekSpeak. Can anyone remember any of the key services that we've talked about before?
Well, I mean, the thing is, PGP is the one that I've always talked about as being okay. an awesome thing. But the problem is there's no service directly for PGP.
Oh, I see.
You basically have to find your friend and give them your public key and vice versa. In fact, you can have key exchange parties. But even even hey. That is kind of difficult. The other thing that you can do is, like, I have my public PGP key mm-hmm. is up on my website, right? Because I own that domain and I control it. So assuming that you trust that that's the case, you could go get my PGP from there. And then you could also look me up in the services, if you will, from my email address. And there'll be a service that gives you my PGP, but there's no authentication mechanism for that. So it's difficult.
So it's really a person-to-person, geeks can do it for each other.
That's kind of the problem. Yeah. And PGP in general isn't built into most email applications by default. In uh-huh. fact, I was so frustrated at this, I wrote a whole document up about how PGP works and why it works and how to get it installed on your Mac Mail. And now I don't know if anyone uses Mac Mail anymore, but we'll have that linked in the show notes if you want to see my description of it on my website.
All right. So it sounds like there is a service hole in that there is not a key service.
Yeah, so if you look at the two basic problems there, having the software on your email client and then having a way to exchange the keys, Facebook would like to solve one of those problems. They are rolling out slowly. This may not be in everybody's Facebook account, but you can go to your profile now and put in your public key. I went ahead and did it today. It's fairly simple if you know what a public key is and you know how to either generate it or pull it out of your key library. Your keychain.
Why is Facebook doing this?
Well, that's
the
thing.
First off, awesome, totally awesome. Why?
So first, let's see what this solves. If you can pretty much guarantee, if everybody starts doing this, if you can guarantee for the most part that you can go to somebody's Facebook profile, mm-hmm. find their public key, somebody will surely write some sort of application that will make this easier. There'll surely be some sort of API that developers can use. And all of a sudden we have a fairly universal key exchange system that people can rely on. And then
So many people are on Facebook?
Because so many people use Facebook. And
but it's all the old people now. What about the young people who are indiscriminately putting their party photos up on Snapchat?
The thing that's really interesting about this Facebook thing is that PGP has this idea of a circle of trust. So if I trust Brian, I know him in person, and he and I have exchanged our public keys, then he can, with his public key, sign Ben's key, saying, I know that this public key that is here, I've confirmed that this is Ben's, and I've confirmed that this is Lyle. And then Ben and I can both get together.
So you're effectively vouching for our private key, our public keys being what our public keys are.
So it's a circle of trust.
Facebook stamp of approval.
Well, no, this is without that. That's built into PGP. That circle of trust is fundamental to trust. That's how we develop trust.
Yeah.
And so what Facebook is saying is you pretty much know the person you're chatting with on Facebook is the right person because you know their friends and they're all connected and you engage with them. So you already have a circle of trust built into Facebook.
So what's the problem with having a nice, easy-to-use key exchange program where anyone who knows anybody can get the other person's key so we can send encrypted messages and everything? That seems like a universally good thing, right?
It does, but it's also a little counterintuitive. If anybody can use it, is it really all that encrypted?
Well, no. That's the public-private key exchange system. It's a very secure system. If you trust that this is the person you want to talk to, if I know that public key actually represents you, Bonnie, mm-hmm. then it's a great way to send you a message because only you can to open that message and read it.
Yeah, and we've gone into more detail about how public keys versus private keys work and how signing of messages works and encryption and decryption works. So, like, that part is secure. Is there a downside to you, Brian?
Okay, so the downside is Facebook wants to be your identity.
Right. How does this benefit Facebook? That's what I want to know.
Facebook wants to be the identity system on the internet. They want to want us to use them to prove our identity. And this is a bigger leap in that direction for them, for us to incorporate one company into our lives so much that we can't live without them. So if we're relying on secure email communication and it's all tied up with Facebook, that's yet another dependency we have on
them. Okay.
We're
collecting those up, aren't we?
So I guess I kind of want to challenge that a little bit, because if effectively the argument I hear you making is, I'm not so hot on this because it makes Facebook more attractive and I don't want to be attracted to Facebook.
But we are. No,
what I worry about is the fact that this is a great idea.
Yeah.
I love the idea. I don't like the fact that it's Facebook doing it, because if we rely just on Facebook for this key exchange, I'm worried about it making all the other ones atrophy and go away until
okay.
the point that they're the only
because
game in town.
It's although there's an advantage in having everyone hanging out in the same place to get their keys.
Right. No.
There's a disadvantage in only being able to go there.
Right. So
and perhaps similar things not being developed, because what other company is going to be beefy enough to provide a...
Well, there are other companies out there that could do this, and that's what I would like to see.
Okay, so if Facebook were doing this and other places were doing this, that still might be a little bit iffy, because so many people are on Facebook. And because so many people are on Facebook, it pushes, I guess, the ecosystem of people towards using Facebook more for it, which could mean that the other services get less use and atrophy. Is that kind of the argument?
Well, there are other key exchange services
sure.
out there. Yeah, yeah. And the reason why they're not used much is because nobody knows about them.
Okay.
And Facebook has the advantage that everybody knows who they are, and they can start relying on them. But I would love to see some other companies get into this. But of course, then you have to start asking yourself, where is your public key hosted on?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is your public key hosted on Google? Is it on Facebook? Is it Apple's servers? And once again, we get back to that question. You can't rely on one place to go. So maybe email is just broken.
You know, this is a fascinating conversation and kind of a fascinating place that we're in right now. As the security of systems is broken more and more, not because of technical reasons, but because people just aren't engaging with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's like security, the idea of security as a PR issue, right? There aren't enough people who both value it and are willing to put time into it to be secure.
And grok it enough.
And grok it enough, right? So if a company like Facebook can make this easy, then that's a win in a lot of ways. But it also means that we're more likely to have that be centralized on Facebook and the other services atrophy a bit more. Because people who find it through Facebook are going to be on Facebook and are probably not going to go away to other services or whatnot. Whereas if you have Facebook and you have Apple and you have Google, all of the big companies, all the big places that people who are not as security-minded congregate, then you have a bunch of services who are providing this good service in a way that people who are not security-minded can interact with it, and then hopefully bring the floor of our of our collective security and encryption.
Well, maybe this is a first step, right? Facebook might be the educators, weirdly, of people around the need for keys.
It could be, but there's going to have to be a lot of improvements in the system.
Oh, really? How's the functionality?
Well, meaning email clients. The other thing that we were identifying is email clients are just not making this easy.
Easy to use, even if you had the public key and you knew who it was. I mean, this is just making sure they confirm the public key. One thing they are doing is they're trying to validate the PGP. My PGP, which I've been using for years, my key is not being validated by Facebook. So whether it's actually fully functional or fully baked is questionable. Maybe I'm the one that's not doing a good job here. But it is one of those things that's in early stage. The thing that's nice is that PGP is an open standard, and they're embracing an open standard. So whatever that whatever occurs from this point on, at least it validates PGP as a good solution for this kind of privacy.
Okay, so it's a win for open source folk.
Absolutely.
So, I was wondering why you were so quiet over there, Lyle. You were on Facebook.
He's checking it out, seeing if it worked.
Checking it out.
This is great. We talk about things and we check them out live.
Now, what if Facebook actually let us start signing Facebook messages with our key so that Facebook couldn't read the messages we're sending to other Facebook users?
I would feel
a lot better about Facebook then, which I do check every day.
It'd be hard for them to make money, though.
Yeah, it would be.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's how Facebook is lightly disturbing but potentially helping. It's hard to tell. And what about GM? It used to be car culture. Car culture's on the way down. A lot of kids are like, I don't need a driver's license. I could just FaceTime.
Well,
so
GM is embracing the current era of copyright and privacy concerns in an interesting way. GM has joined forces with John Deere, the tractor-making company, and they are using the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to enforce the idea that you cannot get access to how your GM vehicle works. And if you try to take your vehicle to a shop that's not controlled by GM, they will sue you.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
what does that mean?
Okay, so
if you try to fix your car
without their involvement,
then they'll sue you.
Yes.
Because
the argument goes like this. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act puts into place this idea that it enforces the idea that if someone tries to supersede and bypass any kind of security measures on software and hardware for that matter, because all hardware kind of requires software if it has a processor in it, if you try to bypass any kind of security feature, you are therefore breaking the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and you are in violation of that act and doing something illegal.
Just the DMCA is a horrible piece of legislation.
It is really bad, and it's still there. So, so what this means is that GM is claiming that the software in their car, which of course is required to use their hardware, has security features around it, and therefore, if you try to backwards engineer how it works, you are in violation of the DMCA, and you can be taken to court and such.
Okay.
The long and the short of that, though, is that you don't really own your vehicle, because if you have a vehicle and something goes wrong with it, you have to go to GM and you have to pay them to repair it, because they're the only ones that can actually look at the software. It's the same thing as any kind of encrypted, like a DVD. You don't own the DVD, you own a license to the DVD. Mm-hmm. You don't own music on a CD, you actually own a license to music.
Right. This is the world that we're entering into, where it's not about me and mine. It's about, can I borrow that, please, dear corporation?
And cars, too.
Yeah. Wow. It's spread to cars now.
So don't buy a GM.
I guess. But, I mean, it seems like a matter of time, doesn't it, before other people try that argument? I guess it depends on if they succeed.
Well, the great thing about this one is that it's so ridiculous, the idea that you wouldn't own your car after you buy it, that a normal judge is going to go, no, we got to change this.
Well, it's ridiculous to us oldsters, to young people who are used to paying monthly for a stream of music or a stream of entertainment or Zip cars or Uber. Owning a car has less cachet and might not have the, hey, you can't take my apple pie.
Right. So the license agreement that you approve when you get a GM vehicle can be modified any time by the GM. Mm-hmm. Therefore, GM could say GM vehicles cannot be used by Uber. And even if you own the vehicle, you would be in violation if you use it for Uber.
Specifically an Uber thing?
No, I'm just gave an example of Uber, and I'm just saying that GM owns the vehicle. You don't. You lease the vehicle. You license the vehicle from them. That's the right.
But there's so many Uber drivers who are already licensing a vehicle from someone else to be able to.
That's true too. I'm sorry I brought in Uber again, but my point is that GM is basically saying you don't own this vehicle. You don't own the software in this vehicle, and therefore it's licensed, and we can modify that license agreement anytime, and you've already agreed to it. So even though you own the vehicle itself, you cannot use the vehicle without our say-so.
Yes, and for us, that's shocking. And so, what I'm saying is that perhaps not for all aged Americans, that is shocking.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm young. It's shocking to me, but I hear that perspective is like, you know, if you grow up not owning MP3s, for example, you instead use your Spotify subscription. I mean, do you own that music? No, you clearly don't. You're streaming it, right? It's just such a difficult argument to swallow when you have a physical thing in front of you, you know?
Like, exactly.
Th- this sits in my driveway.
Right.
Because what I really want to be able to do is copy that car and have two of them now.
I just want to loan it to my friend.
Don't copy that floppy.
Oh, no. All right. So that's the world we're living in, and congratulations. We'll talk more about it next week. This has been Geek Speak for...
I think it's the June 6th.
Yes, the June 6th episode. Oh, there we are showing off our pre-recorded stripes. And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. We're very friendly to the open source. And what that means is you can reuse our stuff any way you like. All you got to do is tell them the geeks say hi and mention that you got it from us. This, by the way, is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org. You can also email us, if you don't think that email is broken, at geeks@geekspeak.org. You can contact us on Twitter. Who knows if that's any safer? We're at KUSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and Brian Young. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. We really should provide some sort of MST 3000 kind of commentary stream for people to watch as Greg comments along as we do the show. It's quite funny. Thanks to all of you for being here for this June 6th, 2015 episode of Geek Speak.